Well, good evening, everyone. Thank you. Thank you so much for coming, and thank you, virtual audience, for attending. We love having you here. We really appreciate it. One of the things we do, excuse me, is my long-suffering husband, decided that he would make a podcast of all of the soundtracks from Zoom, and I looked today, and he said 246,100 podcast downloads in the last 3 years, which I think is really wonderful. And he's working on an index because the number of authors who are now in our Facebook and YouTube videos and podcasts is so enormous. If you, for example, wanted to see Alice and me talking in her garden shed 3 years ago, it would be a lot of work now to find it. But if he gets this index organized, it'll make it lots easier. So there we are. Anyway, back to the International Mystery Convention. There were panels and separate programs for separate authors. But Alice was on a couple of panels, one with Ellie Griffith, who, if you read Ellie, I couldn't persuade her to change her plane ticket and come tonight. She was going back to England. And you all talked about, in part, writing books, what your pace is for writing books. And you said at that point that Daisy Darker took you, how many years was it?
5 years.
5 years.
5 years. Five long years. Daisy Darker was my most badly behaved book. I've had all of my book writing experiences have been very different. I like to write different books every year because as a reader, I like to read something different all the time. But I remember when I wrote Daisy for the first time, I spent 9 months locked away in the shed where we first met. And I wouldn't let anybody read the book. I decided that there was something wrong with it and I wasn't sure what was wrong with it. So I sent an email to my agent saying, I'm so sorry, I can't send you the book. And he said, okay, well, don't panic. He sounded slightly panicky. He said, don't panic. You've got 3 months. Maybe we talk to your publishers about delaying your deadline for the next book. And I said, nope, there's another book in my brain. I think about it all the time. I can write 3 drafts in 3 months and hand it in. And that book was His and Hers. And that was a very well-behaved book. Well done, His and Hers. Very well-behaved book, 3 months. And in comparison, Daisy was 5 years. So they're all very different. I love them all, but Daisy has a special place in my heart because it was so very difficult. And I really wanted to tell her story the right way. And I was so happy in the end when I could finally hand her in. And my agents liked the book. My publishers liked the book. And a lot of you lovely readers enjoyed the book. So all of it was worth it. All those hours in the shed were worth it in the end.
Well, Cornwall's a magical place, and everybody loves a gothic story set in Cornwall. For example, Rebecca. So, you know, it was bound to. But did you always know where it was going, or did in all these drafts, did the working out? It was a very complicated plot.
It was a very complicated plot, and I'm, as you know, a bit of a planner, so I have to plan the books before I can write a word of them. There's a huge chart in my little, I still call it a shed. It's not technically a shed, but I still call it the shed. There's a huge plan on the wall with different coloured cards, and the different coloured cards are for different characters or different timelines. Sometimes there are bits of red string on there, and it looks like the work of a crazy person, and I hope the police will never show up. But it was a really difficult book for reasons I almost can't explain. And when 2 years later I read it again, you know, this book that I couldn't let anybody else read, I could finally see what was wrong with it. And I could finally see how to solve the problem. And the first thing I needed to do was delete 80,000 words, which when my books tend to be about 85,000 words, it means deleting quite a few of those words that you spent 9 months working on. But it was the right thing to do. And it was the same story, same setting, same characters. But this time I knew them so well that it just seemed to come together. And then it behaved itself the way I wished it had 5 years earlier.
It probably couldn't. I mean, I think it needed to stew in your head. So how does your family take it when you are in the shed drawing with red string and all the rest of it, never to appear and whatever, you know? Are they okay with your sort of hermetical author life?
I'm very lucky in that my family are so supportive of what I do, but I do turn into a bit of a hermit when I'm writing. And the only person who is allowed in the shed with me is the dog. So the dog comes up every morning, sits on my feet, and he's great at telling me when to take a break because he wants a walk, really, quite selfish. But he's brilliant company, and I need everything to be quite quiet when I'm working. And I live in a very rural corner of Devon these days, so it is very quiet, apart from the dog snoring, which I confess can be a little distracting at times. But no, I'm really lucky. I do have support in that way, and when I'm doing intense edits, like I was just before I came to America for this book tour, I'm sometimes up at 4 a.m., and everyone's got used to that now. Including the dog. And he knows it's not breakfast time yet. We just have to go to the room and sleep for a while. And then a few hours later, it's time to get up and have something to eat and go for a walk.
So you mentioned to me in the back room that your husband feels that you're only happy when you're writing. Mm. Is that true? I mean, writing can really take over your life.
I feel as though we're all addicted to something. And I think we're all addicted to something because we all need some form of escape. The world at the moment is often far too loud. And for me, when the world gets too loud, I tend to like to disappear inside a story. So that can either be reading a story or watching a story or writing a story. But these days, I think that writing is a bit like a drug, as in the more I do it, the more I have to. So I think I might be getting faster, maybe. No more daisies that take 5 years. But I also, it's something I really miss if I'm not doing it. So I'm between books right now. So I handed in next year's book, you'll be pleased to know, just before I came here. I handed it in to my agents on the Monday, and they know I get really anxious when I hit send. It's still very traumatic hitting send when you've been working on something in secret for months and months. And then on the Thursday afternoon, I had the email with a thumbs up saying that I'd done it. And it's just the best feeling in the world because it doesn't get any easier, this job. I still get really scared every time. I want to write the best book I can possibly write. So I have a little tradition at home now where when I start a book, I buy a bottle of champagne, and I write the book number, and I write the date, and I put it in the fridge. So I think I put this year's champagne in the fridge in February. So then every day, I mean, if you think about how often you go inside the fridge, right, especially when you're stressed, I mean, especially when you've got books that aren't always behaving themselves. So every time I open the fridge, I could see the champagne, and I'm not allowed to open it until my agent says, you've done it with this book. So yes, in February, all the way through to a couple of weeks ago, I kept seeing it and I kept seeing it. And then the week before I came to America, I got to open the champagne. And it just felt great. It's always still such a...
Sorry.
Those tops are so difficult to open on the bottles, aren't they?
I'm sorry, Alice.
Oh, no, don't be silly.
Carry on.
Yes. So I think if you're... are there any aspiring writers here tonight? There's normally one or two. Maybe you're just being shy. There we go. Well done. Yes. I think if you're trying to write, I always think there are three pieces of advice I have. Number one is to read a lot, because if you're going to be a writer, I do think reading is pretty critical. It's up high up there. Number two is to write, because I can't tell you the number of people I have met who tell me they want to write, but they don't have time, as though perhaps I was gifted some extra time more than everybody else. And number three is just to never give up, because I always think if you don't give up on something, then you can't fail at it. So for anyone who's secretly trying to write out there, that's what I'd say to you, because I was a secret writer for a very long time. And I'm sure some of you know that it was 10 years for me of secretly scribbling away, secretly sending off the books, secretly and very, very sadly collecting all those rejection letters and putting them in the file. So when I finally got my deal, it was a pretty special moment. And I think I'm very lucky and I have the best job in the world.
Are there any full manuscripts that will never see the light of day?
Oh, yes. And they should never see the light of day. Yes, there were quite a few before I got my agent and before I got published. And I think, I like to think that I got better as a writer. I think it's like anything. It's like playing the piano. The first time you sit down, it's probably going to be a little bit shaky there. So I think I got better. And there are still books now. There is a book a few years ago, which I sent to my agent and he wasn't sure about it. And I said, well, then I'm not going to publish it. And he said, are you sure? Do you think someone else should read the book? And I said, nope, if you say that it might not be good enough, then I won't publish it. Because I think when you send a book out into the world, you're asking your readers to basically give up a day of their lives, which is a huge thing to ask from anybody. So I'll never ever publish a book unless I secretly hope it might be good, because you deserve nothing less than that, really. So yes, there are secret books that will be found that day when I get hit by a bus sometime in the future. And maybe they're brilliant. Maybe they were the best ones.
Actually, I remember, I think it was a couple of years ago, you talking about that manuscript that you pulled.
Yes.
And is it fair to ask you to give us some information about that, or
no,
why you
pulled it? No, it's not fair at all.
Okay. It just was the wrong topic at the wrong time? Or?
Yes, I think so. And like I said, there are books which can just be badly behaved. Or you'll come back to them a few years later and suddenly all those pieces will slot into place. But I've read books by authors I love where I just think, at the end, you know? And I also think that books have to be fair. If you're writing twisty thrillers like I try to do every year, you have to have clues in there. There is nothing worse than when you get to the end of a book like that and there's some crazy twist that you could never have guessed. That's not fair. The book needs to be thrown out of the window. So no, I always think you have to plant those clues. You have to leave the breadcrumbs. It has to be a fair game, because it is a game you're inviting readers to play, I think. We're going to try and solve a mystery together, and we're going to go on a roller coaster ride together with various twists and turns. And by the end of it, I hope we might have been a little bit scared, a little bit confused, a little bit thinking, what on earth is going on here? But by the end, I hope that we will have had a good time together.
For the folks who weren't here last time, can you talk a little bit about Daisy Darker, which was kind of a breakout book, definitely here in the States. Talk a little bit about that book.
I loved Daisy Darker. Has anyone here read Daisy? Oh, look at you. I love all of you as well. You're my favorite readers. Well done. Yeah, I love that book so much. I guess part of it was written during the pandemic. And we were, I don't know about you and your families, but we were playing a few board games in a way that we hadn't for a while. And Cluedo was one of them, which you call Clue here. It's Cluedo back home. I do not know why. So I think that was very much in my mind with the floor plan at the start. I wanted all of my readers to be able to picture Seaglass, this crumbling Gothic manor on the Cornish coast. And it's on a tiny tidal island, so it gets cut off whenever the tide comes in. And I just loved the idea of this family, the Darker family, who are actually all a little bit dark, let's face it. And I love the idea of them being trapped and then something happening. And there are some characters in that book, perhaps because it took 5 years, who I still miss, even now. And it's very strange sometimes as an author. Your characters can feel as real to you as you are to me now. They're there all the time. You sometimes hear them whispering. I sound crazy. I just heard that out loud. No, so I do. I miss Daisy, and I miss Nana from Daisy Darker, who would sometimes come out with these lines as I was typing, and it felt like it was her, not me. It was, and I think, oh, that's it. I love that. Thanks for saying that. I'm going to remember that. That's good advice. Thank you, Nana. So, and Poppins the dog, of course. There's always a dog in my books. And we should do it. We should say that, you know, spoilers for anyone who's worried when reading my books, the dogs will always be okay. You don't need to worry about the dogs.
Hopefully the cats, yes, too, right?
Well, I can't promise about cats. I'm definitely a dog person. And you should definitely be worried about the humans. I can't promise they're all going to be fine, yes. But the dogs, fine. Oh, my goodness, don't bring up Cheeks. Has anyone read I Know Who You Are?
You okay?
Yes. I'm very sorry about Cheeks the hamster. Oh, I had no idea that when Cheeks met his fate in a deep fat fryer, that so many people might be so upset with me. Cheeks wasn't real. Cheeks wasn't a dog, it was a hamster. But yes, for anyone who is upset or has a deep love of hamsters, I do apologize.
All animal life is a rule in crime fiction. That the animals always survive, but plenty of people can die, right?
Very
works
much
out
so.
That way. You all be glad to know that I've had two negative COVID tests today. So it's the air conditioning. Anyway, let's talk a little bit about good, bad girl. Do you know, for some reason, I want to call it good girl, bad girl. Any of you had that same reaction? I had to, you know, get rid of the comma, good, yeah. bad girl. And the opening of this book is really extraordinary. And then, cruel you just leave us hanging.
Well, there was no hamster this time. I do think I deserve some brownie points for that. But,
that's true.
Yes. Well, I think this book was a bit of a different journey for me. I think it's quite an emotional book. And I think at the heart of this story, it's a story about mothers and daughters. And I just think that relationship, the mother-daughter relationship, is so complex and so unique. It was something I just felt like I really wanted to write about. I've had a lot of strong women in my life, and it was this story that just haunted me, and I kept thinking about these characters. And I think whether good or bad, the relationship that you have with your mother is one which cannot fail to shape you as a person. And I'm sure that there will be some people in the audience who, like me, sometimes say something and realize it's something their mother used to say that they absolutely can't stand, and now they find themselves saying it. Or perhaps even worse, sometimes you look in the mirror and you can see her there. And sometimes lately I see my grandmother, which is something even more I think I need to worry about. But those relationships, those early moments, they really do shape us, and I think sometimes they haunt us. And I really wanted to write this book about mothers and daughters, which does start with a bit of an interesting chapter.
Why
don't
you read the opening couple of
lines? I can if you want.
Yeah, I really think you should, because
should I read the opening for you?
Then you'll go home and open the book as soon as you get there. Hopefully not in the car while you're driving.
So it starts with the dedication, which for this book is for daughters of mothers of daughters. I'll let you ponder on that. And also we start at the end because I like to keep things different. So the end, Mother's Day. People say there's nothing like a mother's love. Take that away and you'll find there's nothing like a daughter's hate. I told myself things would be different when I became a mum. I was determined not to make the same mistakes as my mother, and I believed that my child would always be loved. That's what I promised my daughter the day she was born. But I have made mistakes, bad ones, and I've broken my promise more than once. I feel drunk from tiredness. My mind is a mess, and my thoughts feel slow, jumbled, clouded by the fog of exhaustion. But she needs things, and she needs me to get them for her. Doing, finding, being what she needs became my occupation the day she was born. A job I thought I wanted, and now I can't quit. Being a mother is a curious mix of love, hate, and guilt. I worry that I might be the only person who ever felt this way, and despise myself for thinking unthinkable thoughts. I wish my daughter would disappear. I push the buggy along the high street, hoping to get inside the supermarket before the rain comes, when an elderly woman blocks my path. "Isn't she adorable?" she says, staring at the sleeping child before beaming back at me. I hesitate, searching my befuddled brain for the correct response. "Yes." "How old?" "6 months." "She's beautiful." "She's a nightmare." "Thank you," I say. I tell my face to smile, but it doesn't listen. "Please don't wake her." That is all I ever think, because if someone or something wakes her, she will start to cry again. And if she cries again, I will cry again, or do something worse. Inside the supermarket, I hurry to get the things I need. Baby formula, nappies, coffee. Then I see a familiar face, an old colleague. And for a moment, I forget how tired I am all day, every day. I listen to the childless friend who has become a stranger talk about their life, which sounds significantly more interesting than mine. I live alone and I miss having conversations with adults. We chat for a while. I mostly listen, as I don't have much to say. Every day is exactly the same as the day before for me now, and while I listen, I forget that I no longer have any dreams or ambitions or a life of my own. My daughter became my world, my purpose, my everything the day she was born. I sometimes wish she hadn't been. I know I must never share these thoughts or speak them out loud, so instead I pretend to be okay. I pretend to be happy. I pretend to know what I'm doing. I'm so good at pretending, but it's exhausting. Like everything else in my life, like her. The conversation lasts less than 3 minutes. My back is turned less than two. 1 minute later, my world ends. The buggy is empty. Dun, dun, dun.
And then aren't there like three sentences at the top of the next chapter?
Yes. Yes.
Those are the ones that I thought was really...
Oh, I didn't get to the good ones, Mark.
No.
Said. You'll have to read on for those.
Yeah. You will.
Yeah.
It's a, excuse me, a very surprising book, as Alice's books are. Also, this one, instead of in rural Cornwall, this book is set in London.
Yes.
So you decided, well, I guess logistically, it almost needed to be somewhere in a metropolitan area.
Yes, I think I always tend to write about places that either I've lived or I've visited many, many times. So Cornwall is where I go every year on my birthday, and I have done for years. And there's this secluded part of the coast where I always picture sea glass. And I wish that sea glass was a real place. It isn't. It just lives in my peculiar imagination. But that's where that setting came from. I've set more than one book in Scotland. I adore Scotland. I think I should live there. I think it's so beautiful. So next year's book, Secrets, is set in Scotland. I think because I miss it so much when I'm not there, I enjoy spending my time writing about being in Scotland, because then it feels like I am there again. But with this book, I think the relationships within this book are so intense and so claustrophobic that it had to be set in a city. I think sometimes the settings in books almost play characters in themselves. So when I have a book set up in Scotland, like Rock, Paper, Scissors, if anyone has read that one, it's very wild and unspoilt and unpredictable, almost like the marriage in that story. And with Good Bad Girl, it had to be something very intense and claustrophobic, and a setting where, like any city, in London you can be surrounded by literally millions of people and feel so very alone. And I think that's so interesting about us as human beings, how we can be surrounded by people just like us, but they're strangers. And so this feeling of loneliness was something that came through with all of the characters. The characters are very different, but something might connect them all. And I felt as though the one thing they all had in common was intense loneliness, sometimes through choice. Sometimes not.
But London, while it's a giant metropolis, originally was a small city with walls and a lot of villages all around it. And gradually, the villages have become part of London. So London has very different personalities.
Yes.
In very, actually, reasonably close together spaces, doesn't it?
It does. You can walk just a few blocks, you would say, here. I'm learning. On the sidewalk, not the pavement, and it's almost like a different world. There are certain pockets of London, especially in West London. If you're in Notting Hill, 1 minute you can be surrounded by wealth and opulence, and the next second it's something very, very different. So, yeah, it's a very interesting place.
So which neighbourhoods did you select for writing the book?
Well, I selected Notting Hill because I used to live there. So again, I think I like to write about places which I know. I think it hopefully gives the story a sense of authenticity in that way, because I have lived there and I have experienced those things. And one of the characters in the book is Frankie, who is a prison librarian and a character that I loved writing because she's so very strange. She's so very strange, but so endearing. And Frankie has reached a stage in her life where she feels like she can't count on people. No people. She doesn't trust anybody. And because she can't count on people, she's decided just to start counting numbers inside her head. So she'll count her steps everywhere that she goes, and she'll count certain things. And there are things that she will think will be lucky or not lucky, and she'll let her whole day be determined by these strange things that happen only inside her head that nobody else would be aware of. But she came from a visit to a prison library in London, which I did a few years ago. I should hasten to add, for work, for being an author, I wasn't in prison. I didn't take my research a step too far and end up behind bars. So no, I think Frankie was born on that visit to a London prison. And then the rivers, there are river boats in this book as well. And I think London is so connected by this water, you know, by rivers and all this connection. So I felt as though that was a really nice way to have a way that the characters could perhaps get away if they needed to. You know, I don't write those books with car chases or explosions, but I always like to give my characters a way to escape should they need to. And this time I chose riverboats, which go at 5 miles an hour. So it was interesting.
Right. Well, there are canals in London. Actually, London is indeed a city built over rivers. For example, Fleet Street is actually built over the River Fleet. Christopher Fowler. Did you ever meet Christopher Fowler?
No, I didn't know that. So that's interesting.
An incredibly wonderful, talented British author who sadly died. Poor man went in to get a COVID test and learned he had cancer, which was a dreadful thing. But anyway, he wrote a whole series of very funny but beautifully grounded books in both London geography and history. And in one of them, in the book, the mystery is that a woman, drowns in a perfectly dry room. And how can that be? And so the book is about all the rivers that still flow under London, and, you know, down to the Thames, essentially, and how gradually they've been paved over, and then, you know, London developed in the great stink in Victorian London, which was 1867 or something, I think. The city decided that instead of using all its rivers for sewers, they were going to actually have to create a sewer system. So, you know, it goes on and on. Prison librarian, I love that. Do you know, we have a prison librarian who called us. I think isn't there a prison out west here? I'm trying to remember, where is the prison? Metro Phoenix. Right, that's it. Well, anyway, he called me one day and wondered if we had any books we could donate to the prison. And I said to him, you are aware that we are primarily a crime bookstore. And he said, yes, but they liked really good reads. And the only restriction was that we couldn't give them any true crime. I love that. I thought that was so funny. So,
I remember when I was giving the talk at the prison, they were asking about my next book. So it was, yeah. I just done Sometimes I Lie, my first book. And I confessed that I'm really secretive when I write. So nobody knows anything about my books, even my agents and my publishers. They don't even know the title until I finish them. I think it's bad luck. And agents and publishers don't really like that way of working. But it works for me, so that's what I do. But I do remember in the prison, them asking about the next book. And then someone just put up their hand and said, okay, but does somebody die in it? And I said, of course. And then they all cheered. And I knew that I had readers for book two and it was all going to be fine.
That's wonderful, Alice. You should work there. Well, anyway, I mean, prison librarian is, you know, I'm a librarian originally by training. And I never really thought about prison librarians until fairly recently, but they're quite valued, you know, because you have to keep all those people occupied. And with any luck, if the idea is to rehabilitate people, how do you do that if you can't give them access to things that would theoretically improve them, such as not true crime, but other kinds of books, you know? So does Frankie have any sense of that? Why is she a prison librarian? Is it just a job, or, you know, does she have some kind of calling for it, or what's the deal?
Frankie, like me, I suppose, is always hidden inside stories. So she had quite a difficult childhood, and her first job was in a bookshop in Devon, in St. Ives. And that's definitely because I visited a bookshop in St. Ives on tour once, and I thought it was lovely. So, of course, one of my characters had to work there. And then trying to find a job that worked with childcare was something that was very difficult for her. And she saw this advert for a prison librarian, and she didn't have a huge amount of experience, but she did have a lot of experience of working with books. And so she got the job, and she was terrified at first, as I think a lot of people would be. But like anything, we're often scared of things we don't know. And it's the unknown that we're fearful of. So soon it became routine for her. And so she turned this library into a very dark and from a dark and dingy space into something pretty amazing, where she would write off to authors, to publishers, asking, do you have any spare books? Is there anything you can donate for us? And I think that she was one of these people who helping other people helped her. It was the one thing that she could do. If she could help other people, it made her feel better about some of the mistakes she might have made in her life before.
So moving on, let's go to the care home. Now, care home is British for nursing home. And so you have another of your characters works in a care home.
Yes. So we've got Patience, who works in the care home. And we've got Edith, who is living in the care home and doesn't want to be living in the care home. As far as she's concerned, she was tricked into living there by her children. She doesn't want to be there. She misses her dog, Dickens. I love coming up with names for dogs in every book. We had Poppins in Daisy Darker, and we've got Dickens in Good Bad Girl. And I think if they ever met, they'd play with a tennis ball really happily together. But Dickens is sadly taken away from her because dogs aren't allowed in the care home. And Patience forms a very close relationship with Edith while she's caring for her in the care home. And so she goes to the adoption centre where Dickens was left, adopts the dog and brings the dog to visit Edith, which made me really love Patience as a character because she's very young. She's only 18. It's a big thing for her to have done. And I used to work in a care home many, many years ago, over 20 years ago. Feels like a different life now, but it was probably the hardest job I've ever had and the lowest paid job I've ever had. And it's such an important job. I wanted to thank carers in this book because especially during the pandemic, I think finally people understood what an important role that is in society. And so Patience, although very young, is doing this job, which I think is so important and so valuable and something which we should all be incredibly grateful for. And I love the bond these two characters have. Edith in her 80s, Patience who's 18. And basically, Edith wants to escape and she's looking for someone to help her.
Breaking out of the nursing of the care home. I love it. Right. So that's now two prisons. Where's the, if you really think about it. So there's a fourth person who is in a different kind of prison.
So Cleo has built a prison of her own. Cleo lives in the pink house. So she is thought of as the woman in the pink house in the book. And I'm sure if you've ever seen the film Notting Hill, there are these beautiful houses there and they cost a fortune. And Cleo lives in one of these houses alone. And she is a therapist. So she spends all day helping other people. But she can't help herself. Cleo has a very dark past and very sad things have happened to her. And she's one of those people who puts a brave face on everything. And I think we all know somebody like that. And I think sometimes those people who we have in our lives, who are the happiest, who seem to have it all, who seem most together, they're the ones we have to remember to ask, are you okay? Because Cleo isn't okay, and she has built this prison for herself, which looks so beautiful, this pink, gorgeous house in Notting Hill, but she's trapped. She's trapped in so many different ways. And eventually, through the story, we find out how all of these characters are connected. And I think that's the point where we really understand who they are underneath the disguises that I think we all are guilty of wearing sometimes. The real people, the people we're too scared to let ourselves be in front of others sometimes, those characters then shine through. And I think that's when the story has its best moments.
So, and with Daisy Darker, there's a time span for the characters. You know, we're not just in the present moment. Mm. So in this book, it's a 20-year span, if I remember right.
Yes.
So if you're going to... I suppose if you're going to do these kinds of relationships and all, there's a lot of backstory, which means that you do have to travel back into the past and bring everybody up to the present. Do you have any at the outset, any sense of what the year span is going to be? I mean, did you know
yes,
it was 20 years
was,
or was that
I suppose
just...
For this book, the baby gets snatched from the stroller 20 years ago. So I really had to understand who all of these characters were 20 years ago and how they were feeling. But I always, whenever I meet anybody, I always invent a backstory for them in my head, which I thought everybody did. And I remember being at a party with a friend of mine called Phil, and there were people at the party who I didn't know a couple of years ago. And I was telling him that I'd invented these backstories for other people at the party. And he said to me, "You do know that's not normal, don't you?" And I guess that's why I'm a writer, because that's what I do. I'm inventing backstories for all of you. You guys in the front row now, that's it's all happening. But and I just think that whenever I meet somebody, especially if I meet a baddie, and we've all met baddies in real life, maybe it's your boss. I find it's often the boss is the baddie. But if they're behaving in a certain way, I always think, what happened to you as a child? Yeah. What happened to make you so mean and unpleasant and selfish and awful? And so I often invent a story because I can't ask them in real life.
Do we still have to go out to dinner? I'm rethinking this whole thing. I may just send you, Alice. Go home.
I only have good stories.
Little did I know when she was sitting over there with her glass of wine that in her head she was whirling around. I mean, this is my second try, so we'll see. All right. But that's an interesting thing to do. And you're right. I think that writers, because you can't, you have to draw upon things you know in order to create things that aren't real.
Oh, absolutely. This is all material right now. And my lovely bookshop in St. Ives, which I sound mildly obsessed with, but it's a tiny bookshop and it's so beautiful. At the book signing there last summer, there was a lady in the signing queue after the event, and she asked me to write her name in the book. And it was a terrific name. And so I said to her, I paused and I said to her, "Would you mind if I used your name in one of my future books?" And she said, I was scared in case it might have offended her. And she said, "Yes, that would be amazing." And then she started to walk away and she said, "By the way, my sister's name is," and I won't tell you yet. And the sister's name was even better. So I wrote them both down, and not in next year's book, but the book after that, they're both in it. Not them, they seem like very nice people. And I did sort of warn her, you do know the kind of books that I write, and you do know the kind of characters I write, and you do know that I don't always have happy endings. And she said yes to all of those things. So I think we're fine. Yeah, all of the experiences.
You know, naming is a real art. They must have had very creative parents.
I think they did. I think they should thank their parents. Great names.
I mean, some people have sadistic parents, if you really think about, the names that some... Any of you ever know about the Hoggs? The Hogg family, H-O-G-G, they're a very rich Texas family. And they had two daughters, and they called one of them Ima and one of them Yura. Isn't that cruel? I mean, seriously, can you imagine going to school and saying, "Hi, I'm Hogg"? I mean... I don't think it's apocryphal. I think it's a real story. It's Texas, so anything could happen. But, I do think that that there are some people saddled in life with difficult names. And I often wonder, because you can change your name legally when you're an adult. You can do that. But I often wonder if people's personalities are somewhat shaped by their names. I mean, don't you know? I mean, names have emotional freight. So... you probably all know somebody, if you ran across that name in a book, you would already have a reaction to it, right? Because you have feelings about somebody that had that name. I'm not going to reveal one, but I have one that's just fatal. If I see this name, I'm through with the book. Well, but, I think it's really important. It often comes up in these events where one of you will ask the author how they find their names. And there have been some really great, I'm trying to remember, somebody looks at old military roles. And somebody, phone books are always available.
Graveyards are good.
And graveyards are good. And you don't necessarily take all the name. You might take a first name from this tombstone and a different, last name from another tombstone. And so it can be really interesting, the combination.
So if you ever see me wandering around a graveyard, it's just for work. It's fine.
Yeah. Right. Okay. Well, I don't know. Is there anything else that you would like to say about Good Bad Girl? Because it's a very complex story. And if we said much more, I'm afraid we'd really spoil it. What about the living quarters of the one girl that lives at the top of the back of the...
Oh, in Covent Garden.
Yeah, that was kind of cool. Tell us about that.
So I used to go to Covent Garden quite a lot in my teenage years and in my 20s.
Right.
And it was just somewhere I loved to go and walk around. And it's got this terrific atmosphere and cute little shops. And it's way more touristy these days than it was when I was growing up. But it's still a very special place for me. And there are these very tall buildings with these windows at the very top, very high up, that almost look like eyes, like these strange shaped little windows. And I remember that I hadn't been able to go to London for a long time due to the pandemic. I hadn't left the house for almost 2 years. And the first book event I had to go into London for was quite daunting. I'm sure for some of you, you know, we had that great long period where we weren't going out, we weren't socializing. And then we had to remember how to be normal again. And it was quite frightening. And I remember getting to Covent Garden, and this section of the book, which I had written from memory, I guess. Mm-hmm. And I could suddenly see the window that where patients lived in my dark imagination. And I almost pictured her there, standing at the window, because I'd just been to the printers to print Daisy Darker, and I felt this sense of loss that I had lost this character who I loved so much. And it was almost as though Patience was there saying, "It's okay. I'm here now." And of course, she wasn't really there. That's just my strange cogs turning in the background. And unfortunately, those windows are now above an Apple store, which is not how it is in the book. It's meant to be an art gallery, but that's fine. That's why we all have imagination. So no, it was fantastic to go there again and see all the places where my characters had been walking around in my head.
You know, excuse me again. Here we go. You should take advantage of the architecture or, you know, the special features like Covent Garden. So be a good time to ask for questions.
Yes. Does anyone have any questions? I'm sure you do. Yes.
You want to do the questions?
There is one sequel coming up. Book 10 will be a sequel. I'm not sure I'm going to tell you what it will be the sequel to. So I've just handed in book 7, which will be out next year, which is called Beautiful Ugly. And it's next year's book is quite dark. When I say that to my editor, she says, "All of your books are dark. The next one's quite dark." So yes, there are certain things that connect them, I think, but I like to have a different book every year. And there is a little Easter egg in next year's book, which will make sense to the readers who've read my other books without giving too much away. Yeah. Any more questions? Come on, I know you do have them, really. Yes. Oh, there are so many. I feel like we are in a golden age of literature. I feel like we're so spoilt. There is so much to choose. So I just finished reading Tom Lake. Has anyone read Tom Lake? It's just the most beautiful book. I kept having to put it down because it was so beautiful. I had to stop and think about the story.
Is that the Anne Padgett?
Yes.
Right.
Really just beautiful. Probably one of the best books I've read this year. I always love reading Lisa Jewell's books. We share an agent. So one of the biggest perks of my job is that I always get a proof of her book early every year. I'll never give up writing because it means I get a Lisa Jewell book for everybody else. I love reading her books. In my genre as well, I think that Samantha Downing is a terrific author who always writes something very different and original. And same with Catherine Ryan Howard. I love her books every year too. And I'm currently reading a book which I can't put down, which I was reading until about a minute before I jumped in the car to come here. Now, let me get it right. Murder in the Family by Cara Hunter. Has anyone here read that? I don't even know if it's... I'm not sure if it's out in America. It's not out here yet? Well, when it comes out, buy it. It's terrific. It is such a... I mean, buy mine first. But it's such a page-turner. It's so original. It's if you're a fan of true crime documentaries, it's like that, but fiction and in a book. And I am here for it. I am turning those pages. I'm trying to figure out who did what. So I love reading something that's a bit original every year too, which is tricky in this genre. Sometimes they all feel a bit the same. But I love to read something that feels different and brave and dark and twisty, which is also why I try to write. Yes. I hate the sound of my voice. I really do. It's such a strange thing. I used to work as, I was a journalist at the BBC for 15 years, and there came a point where I started doing reporting on television, and I really enjoyed telling the story. I think there are some similarities between being an author and being a journalist, and it's all about storytelling. At the BBC, there are true stories. In my books, not so much. But the worst part of my job at the BBC was being in an edit suite and hearing myself and seeing myself. So I quite like that with this job, I get to hide away for the majority of the year. Honestly, most of the year, I'm in the shed with the dog and my laptop, writing my stories with my slippers on. And then 2 weeks of the year, they let me out to come and meet all of you. And it's so much fun. And then they lock me up again for, honestly, for the rest of the year until I deliver another book. So this is a highlight for me. And I don't know if I'll ever narrate the books myself, because I wouldn't wish that on you guys. I like you guys so much. Thank you. Did you like my old lady voice? I worked really hard on that. I was quite proud of myself for that bit. Yes. Thank you. Oh, thank you. Yes. Yes. You. See, you understand me, but I'm listening to you and thinking, you've got a lovely voice. Would you like to narrate my books? That would be fine.
Are you good at doing other British accents? Because there's quite a regional variety in England, right?
I think I can only do me. I can do a bit of maybe Cockney stuff.
Yeah?
Can I? All right, Governor? That's about it. That's all I can do.
Do you know any good rhyming slang?
No.
It's fascinating. Do you guys know about Cockney rhyming slang?
Apple and pears. That means stairs. I can't think of any others. Any more?
Elephant's trunk.
What does that mean?
Drunk.
Oh, I wouldn't know. Barbara and I are going for wine later, I do know.
Anybody else?
Yes, any more questions? Yes. Sometimes at certain stages, I tend to read all genres all of the time. I've always been a bookworm ever since I was a child. I've got three on the go at the moment. But there do come certain points. So the edits just before I came here with the 4 a.m. starts and the 10 p.m. finishes, I don't read then because there's no time. There's literally no time to read. But no, I love reading all of the time, really. I feel a bit lost if I'm not reading, in the same way that I feel a bit lost if I'm not writing. And there's a very precarious pile of to-be-read books beside my bed at all times, which one day I fear might be the end of me if I accidentally topple them over in the night. Death by books. Be a good way to go, wouldn't it? Very appropriate for my line of work.
Do you have any interesting writing rituals that you do? Do you have...
We've got the champagne every year goes in the fridge. And one time I was moving house whilst writing the book. And I was so... You know what movers are like. Sometimes things can get broken. I was so scared the bottle of champagne would get broken, because then I would think there was something wrong with the book and probably ditch it in that way that I sometimes do. I have certain things around me all of the time, so there'll be certain things to do with the book, which I tend to have on my desk as little reminders. So one of the characters in next year's book makes pottery. So I've got a vase that I always look at, and I think of her because in my imagination she made it. She didn't, because she's not real. I must remind myself of these things. And on top of my desk, I have a jar of Lucky Kit Kats, which might sound like a strange thing. And I honestly can't remember how it began, but it started with my debut novel with Sometimes I Lie. And I think I was so nervous to talk about the novel that I couldn't eat if I had to do an event. But you know, if you don't eat anything, you can feel a bit shaky or a bit sleepy. And so I had a Kit Kat, and that event went brilliantly. And so now I always have to have Lucky Kit Kats. And whenever I come to America, the Kit Kats I have at home are two fingers of chocolate. Here they're eight. I mean, can you imagine if I lived here? I could probably write 2 books a year, maybe 3. So I might have to think about doing that one day.
What about just, you know, your daily routine for getting the words out? Do you have a certain number of words you shoot for? Or are you a morning writer or a late night writer?
I love that question because it always makes me think that other writers must be so much faster than I am. I'm both. I start quite early and sometimes I'm there till quite late, especially during that first draft. I think with the first draft, I just want to get the story out and on the page as quickly as possible. But 2,000 words is what I aim for every day. And some days you'll do more than that and some days you'll do less. But I think an average of 2,000 is
great.
So
about 8 type double-spaced pages, I guess, right? Yeah.
I don't know.
Something like
yes.
that.
No, it definitely is.
250 yes. words. Yes. That's great. Wow.
Try my best.
What was that famous Oscar Wilde quote? He spent the morning putting the comma in and the afternoon taking it out.
Yes. There are days that are really like that. Or there are days where you feel like you're going backwards almost because you'll find a problem and you'll want to delete everything. But and I polish a lot. So it's 3 drafts before anyone is allowed to read it. Even the dog, because he might tell somebody my secrets. So no, it's quite a solitary job. You do, I don't know whether I would say it's lonely, because I have my characters and they're very noisy sometimes inside my head, but you do spend a lot of time working on your own and then you're allowed out for book tour, which is always the fun part.
Do you have a favorite part of the process? Do you like, you know, getting that story out with the first draft? Or do you like going back in and shaping it and re-editing? And
I think that honestly, being an author, it really is the best job in the world. I feel lucky every day. I still pinch myself on a regular basis. I'm allowed to do this for my job. It took me a long time to get this to be my job. And I'm just very lucky in that I get to work with the best in the business. I have the best agents and I have the best publishers in the known universe. So my job is just to write the books. And then when I send them in, I have the best team. So I don't have to worry after that. So I suppose I love the writing the most because it feels like magic. It feels like this magic experience every time. And it takes quite a long time from when I hit send to when the book is ready for you guys to read. And I always think it's a bit like time travel, as though I'm sitting there in my shed with my dog and my Kit Kats and my slippers, and I'm writing my books. And then 1.5, 2 years later, you're reading this story that was happening in my head so very long ago. And it brings us together because writing is a very solitary thing to do. Reading is something we tend to do on our own. But it's when we all read the same story and share that experience that it becomes this, I think, nothing less than magic, really. I think stories are nothing less than magic when they can bring us together and we all have a different reaction and a response and an emotional feeling when we read them. So I love all of it, but I love the writing the most. And I don't do it like that because that would be strange. That's some sort of piano playing writing that I don't do.
Any other questions?
Yes. Yes, I always know the ending. And I always compare it to walking my dog. So if I were to take my dog for a walk up in the mountains, I'm the kind of person who would need a map. Because if not, I'd be scared the entire time that I was going to get lost or that we were going to fall off the mountain. And writing a book sometimes feels like climbing a mountain. And if I didn't have a map, if I didn't know where I was headed and how I'm going to get back from there, I wouldn't enjoy it as much. There were some authors at BoucherCon who have the complete opposite way of working to me. They just sit there and they make it up as they go along. And I find that terrifying. But again, for any authors in the audience, you have to do whatever works for you. And I have the personality that means I'm scared of getting lost. So I have to know where I'm heading for. Yes. So I remember being in the back of my dad's shop and he had ordered paper for the photocopier and it turned up and it was pink. It was supposed to be white and he couldn't use it because it was pink. And so that paper was given to me. And the first thing I did was make my own book. So imagine these pink pieces of A4 paper, which I folded in the middle, did a bad job of stapling down the middle. I did my own illustrations, very proud of myself. And I wrote my sentences out, and it was probably about 7, I think. And it was basically a ripoff of The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe. But it was a good one. I mean, I think I had some original moments in there. And I think it was really that moment, that it was this dream that maybe one day, because I loved reading books so much, even at a young age, that perhaps I could do it. But I didn't really believe it. And it was only years later, when I was already a journalist, I'd written short stories, I'd entered competitions and lost. I'd been trying and trying and trying. And I wasn't sure it was a job that I was allowed to do, because it is this incredible dream job. For me, this is way more exciting than being a movie star, because if I was a movie star, I'd have to see and hear myself, which we've established I hate. So I desperately wanted it, and I wasn't sure I could do it. So I just kept trying. And I think if you have a dream, whether it's being an author or something completely different, that's all you can do. You just have to keep trying. There are things I know I can't do now because it's too late. I probably can't be a professional ballerina. That ship has passed. I probably can't be an astronaut, but I think I lucked out, because I think I got the best job of all, and it's a job that I love.
Anybody else? Well, we've come to the evening. We always like to give away a book, and thanks again, everybody, for coming out tonight. And so when you purchased a copy of the book, you should have been given a number, kind of a primitive number tonight. And so what we usually do, we'll have Alice pick a number at random between 1 and 46.
It's got to be 13.
13, lucky 13. Anybody have it? Are you saying yes? All right. You, a traitor in Whitehall. There you go.
Thank you.
Please, can I get a photo with all of you so I can remember your faces? Can I? Because they're going to lock me up again for another year, and I won't be back.
Well, thanks so much, everybody, for coming out tonight. And let's give Alice a nice warm round of applause.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.